So we have, as according to our schedule here, we are on our final, last and final quantum lecture. So the thing about quantum is, I mean, quantum is infinite. Okay, there's a million things that you can learn about quantum, okay, and still not understand at all. Okay, so what can we do in like 3 or 4 lectures? Well, we can just hit a couple of highlights and so on and so forth. So this last lecture is going to be just a little bit of a kind of a catch-all for just a couple of really important and interesting points that I thought you might like to hear about. And just looking at the time here, we have to leave a little bit early today, 4:45, because you guys are going shopping tonight. Shopping! Okay, so we have about an hour and a half, and because the break wasn't timed exactly with the food, the snack food, I see that Mark and Michael are bringing in a little bit of refreshments. So what we'll do is we'll just, at the very least, we'll have a drink. Okay, so you might have a snack coming by, and we'll just have a snack while we're eating, because we only have an hour and a half. Okay, so are we ready to go?
Yeah.
All right, okay. So what I wanted to talk about was a little bit more on quantum computing. So we've heard about quantum computing a lot, and we saw the IQC yesterday, and we had Sonia's talk and so on. And I'd like to just add a little bit more to all of that to give you just a better sort of picture of what a quantum computer is. And it involves at least this particular manifestation or physical realization of a quantum computer that I'm going to be talking about relies upon some pretty deep physics, and that's the physics of spin, quantum mechanical spin. So really I'm going to be talking about spin and its application in quantum computing, which is really, really interesting. Okay, so spin, the best place to start with quantum mechanical spin is just with classical spin. Okay, so what I'm talking about here is just some massive object, a spinning top, a massive object that's spinning, and so has some kind of angular momentum. And in particular, we're interested in a phenomenon called precession. Okay, so this is just classical spin and the classical phenomenon of precession. So what I could do is, let me just start with the theory, and then we will see it in action. Okay, so all of you are familiar, this is really, really basic Newtonian physics, so all of you are familiar with Newton's second law. Force equals mass times acceleration. What's another way to write that law in terms of momentum?
E squared over.
Okay, so it can be written as the force applied to an object is the rate of change of its momentum. So if you're not familiar with calculus, I can convert this equation into a simpler form. And it says that, I'll just write it out first, and then describe it. So, oh, a delta here. Okay, so all it says is, if I apply a force F to some object for a certain amount of time, delta t, if I multiply those two quantities, I'm going to get the change in the momentum. So I apply a force to an object, and its speed increases, its momentum increases. The amount of that momentum increase is in the direction of the applied force, and its magnitude is the force times the time over which you are pushing on that object. Okay, so all of us know that. That's just simple Newtonian physics. There's also, so that's for changes in motion of ordinary or changes of ordinary momentum. But when an object, but objects can be in different states of motion. One of them is they can be moving around in space. Another is they can be spinning, okay, and tumbling and so on. So there's an analogous relationship for objects that are spinning or tumbling, okay, and that relationship, well, I won't write down this form, I'll just write down this form here. Okay, which says that if I have some object here, so here is a spinning top here like this, And if I exert a twisting force on that, I should say, okay, first of all, this top is, say, spinning. Say, it's spinning about this axis over here. Okay, and so that means that it has an angular momentum. What is the direction of the angular momentum? It has a kind of momentum, but it's associated with rotation, and that direction is, yeah, up. Okay, so when an object is spinning along this axis here, the momentum associated with that spin is the angular momentum, and that's in that direction, L here. Okay, and now what this equation tells us is that if we apply a torque is a twisting force, if we apply a twisting force to that object, then we will make it either spin faster or slower. So if the torque is applied in this same direction, which means a twisting force, put your thumb in the direction of the torque vector, and then the twisting force is the direction in which your fingers curl. So if we apply a twisting force in this direction, then we will increase the angular momentum. The angular momentum will change by amount delta L, which is proportional to how much twisting force you're applying and the amount of time you're applying it for. Okay, so in this case, L, if we apply a twisting force in the same direction as L, then L will increase, or if we apply it in the opposite direction, L will decrease. Okay? And what's interesting about this is that it leads to some, just this equation leads to some very counterintuitive properties of spinning objects, which all of you will have experienced, you know, riding a bicycle or whatever, or playing with spinning tops and things like that. So what it says is, let's just do a particular example here. So suppose I have a spinning top, which is like this. Okay, so as we talked about a little bit after Sonia's lecture yesterday, if we have an object which is not spinning like this, and we put it on the ground here, so it pivots about that point, then obviously the object is going to do what? It's just going to fall over. Okay, so what's happening is gravity is acting here, and at the end of the day, what it does is it exerts a twisting force on this object about that point. So that twisting force, if I put my fingers in the direction of the twist, then my thumb points in the direction of the applied torque. And so the torque is a vector which is then pointing into the page. So I'm applying a twisting force with the torque in that direction into the page, and you twist it down like that. Okay? And now if the object is spinning, let's suppose the object is spinning, say, in this direction. So we curl our fingers in the direction of the spin, and so the angular momentum is in this direction, L. Okay, so now what's interesting here is that the object will not fall down. Because according to Newton's equation here, applied to rotational motion, it says that there will be when you apply a torque here, then there will be a corresponding change in the angular momentum, which is in the direction of the torque. Okay, so the torque is directed into the page like this, and so it's a vector into the page, and that's the same direction in which the angular momentum will change. So that's into the page. Okay, so if I take this vector here and add a vector which goes into the page like this, then I will get a new angular momentum, which we'll call L prime, which is a little bit behind this one. So here's this one. I've added a small change in angular momentum in that direction, and so the new angular momentum vector is this way. Okay? And then as time goes on, since that torque is constant, as time goes on, we'll just keep doing that. We'll just keep adding a little angular momentum vector, which basically, at the end of the day, turns the angular momentum vector around and around. So what happens is the object processes. So that means that the direction of its angular momentum vector just sweeps out a circle like this, lying on the edge of a cone, like that. Okay, and so it processes. Okay, and so I have this really cool demo of this. I love this thing. Okay, so this is it's a spinning top, but it's not just like an ordinary spinning top. This is a spinning top that is like super high precision, like machined brass. Ooh, it's very nice. Okay, so, and I have a little electric motor here, and I can spin this guy up, get it spinning really, really fast. Okay, so you'll hear it just spinning up faster and faster. So here we go. Okay. Here it goes. It goes really, really fast. And it weighs quite a bit. So there's a lot of angular momentum. So the motor is basically giving it rotational kinetic energy right now, transferring energy from the battery to rotational kinetic energy in this thing. And associated with a high rotational kinetic energy is a large angular momentum. Okay, so it's still spinning up. I don't know. So we could measure the pitch of this thing with a microphone, yeah. Put it on an oscilloscope, and measure that. Okay, so it's really whipping now. And as I handle this thing, it really behaves, it feels really weird, because I push on it one way, and it tends to move the other way. Okay, so let's just stick this thing on here, and we will see. Okay, so it's doing something a little bit more complicated than just processing, it's nutating. Okay, but anyways, we won't get into all the details, but look at that thing. If that thing is not spinning, it would just fall over, clunk, right? But because it's spinning, according to Newton's laws here, the change in the angular momentum is always in that direction. Okay, it doesn't change in that direction. Okay, and so it just sits there and processes around and around and around. And if there were no friction in this little joint there, then and it weren't sort of spinning down because of friction, it would just sit there and process at exactly that angle forever. Okay, so you see it actually continuing to tilt down a little bit. That's just friction. Okay, so it'll actually tilt down quite a ways here. So it's really, really beautiful. So if you play with, how many of you have played with tops? A nice top. Yeah, it's really cool. Okay, and so here it's like all the way sideways. Like that would just for sure tip over if it weren't spinning. And there it goes, just round and around and around. Okay, there we go, touch the table. All right, super. Okay, yeah, I just love this thing. Anyways, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so what has that all this to do with quantum, nature of spin and all that? So let me tell you a bit about that. So actually, before I jump to that, let me tell you about another way in which we could cause that kind of precession. So right here, the torque that is applied to that spinning object comes from gravity, gravitational force. Okay, but we could also have, for example, a spinning bar magnet, and then we could use magnetic forces instead of gravitational to produce the same sort of thing, okay, a precessing spinning object. Okay, so the way we do that is... We have a magnet like this, a north-south magnet. Okay, and suppose that it can pivot about that point. And we put it in a magnetic field. Okay, so we've got a big north bar up here and a big south bar down here. Okay, so this whole thing is in a magnetic field this way, down. Okay, and what's going to happen is this north pole is going to be repelled from that north pole. So there's a force pushing down like that. And this south pole is going to be repelled from that south pole. So there's a force pushing up like that. Okay, there is so this south pole is repelled from that south pole and also attracted to that north pole. And this north pole is repelled from that north pole and attracted to that south pole. Okay, so there's going to be basically a force like this on the object. And so that's a twisting force. There's a torque. Okay, and so the direction of the torque is this way. Okay, so the twisting force is that way. I curl my fingers in the direction of the twisting force, and the torque is into the board. So that's the torque. Okay, so if that object were not spinning, if this magnet could just pivot about that point, then it would just go like this. It would rotate like that and anti-align with the field like that, with the north pole down there and the south pole up there. Okay, so just like our top that's not spinning, it would just fall over. Okay, but now if we make this bar magnet spin, gravity. So we curl our fingers in the direction of the spin, and the angular momentum is then here, in that direction. And then we ask, well, what's it going to do? Well, according to Newton's law, the change in the angular momentum over the next instant of time is going to be in the direction of the applied torque and proportional to how long the torque is applied. Okay, so in this case, the torque is into the page, which means the angular momentum vector, we add to the vector, which is pointing in that direction, we add an angular momentum that way. And so it tips the angular momentum over. Okay, and so at the end of the day, we get a precession like this. Okay, so about that pivot point there, the angular momentum will just turn around and around and around, and it will precess. Okay, and whatever angle we started at, it will stay at that angle forever. Okay, if we ignore friction and all that, which we certainly can do in the case of elementary particles. Okay, so that's how you can get a precession of a spinning bar magnet using a magnetic field instead of gravity. Okay, so is that all totally clear? Okay, super. Okay, so now what I want to do is talk about how this applies to a quantum computer. Okay, so first of all, our discussion is going to be still fairly classical. Okay, so basically, I've just got a picture here. Okay, so we're going to be staring at this picture for a while here. And what we have is, physically, what we have is a molecule, which might have a whole bunch of, made up of a whole bunch of atoms. And we will identify, there's a carbon molecule over here, and there's a hydrogen molecule over here. Okay, and so there's electrons around it and all that kind of stuff. But then inside, deep inside the carbon atom is the carbon nucleus. And that carbon nucleus behaves just like a spinning bar magnet. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about that a little bit later. Okay, so, but just in terms of a sort of a classical picture, we can think of it as a tiny spinning bar magnet. Okay, and what we do is we place that carbon atom, or that carbon nucleus, in a very strong magnetic field pointing downwards. So actually, both of these are in a strong magnetic field pointing downwards. So that's the B field, the magnetic field pointing downwards. And similarly, the hydrogen atom, the nucleus of the hydrogen atom, which is just a proton, also it behaves like a little spinning bar magnet. Okay, and so if the spinning bar magnet is, say, initially oriented that way, okay, then in the magnetic field, it will just precess about this little cone here. And so it'll be doing this sort of thing inside. Okay, and at the IQC, we heard about precession frequencies on the order of tens of megahertz. So one of them, I think, was 75 million times per second. So that's the precession rate here. And the carbon, it's a slightly heavier, actually considerably heavier, and it would probably precess at a slower rate. Okay, so inside here, we've got little precessing spinning bar magnet inside there. Okay, so that's the basic setup. And if the carbon nucleus started in, say, spinning up in the up direction, just like that, okay, then it's already aligned or anti-aligned with the field, and so there's going to be no torque acting on it. Okay, so that's this situation over here. So they're drawing the carbon nucleus and the hydrogen nucleus as little spinning tops like that. Okay, so that's the initial setup. And I should also add something very important here to all of this is that when you have a proton, and it's, let's say it's spinning this way, so its angular momentum is directed upwards like that, then that proton has associated with it a tiny magnetic field. Okay, so the magnetic field that this carbon nucleus experiences is the magnetic field of the external field, which is the field produced by that superconducting coil, a very, very strong field. But added to that is the tiny magnetic field produced by this hydrogen. Nucleus, the proton. Okay, so the magnetic field is this field plus that field, and so it's slightly stronger. Okay, if we orient the hydrogen atom the opposite way, this way, then the magnetic field from the hydrogen nucleus, the proton, will be in the opposite direction, and it will slightly decrease the strength of the magnetic field that carbon nucleus is in. Okay, so just by orienting the nucleus, this proton, different ways, we can vary the intensity of the magnetic field that this carbon nucleus experiences. Okay, and if the carbon nucleus is in a stronger magnetic field, and say it's tilted over, it will precess more rapidly. If it's in a weaker magnetic field, it will precess less rapidly. Okay, so that's a crucial feature. Does everyone see that? Are we all okay with that? Okay. So basically, let's start at the top here. So we just start with nothing happening. Both of them are spinning up like this, and they're not precessing. Okay, to precess, they get a tilt over a bit, and then they precess around. Okay, so they're just both pointing up like this, and nothing's happening. Okay, and then what you do is you apply a magnetic field that's going to tip this guy down. Okay, so you apply a magnetic field, and we talked about how it is you address this particular carbon nucleus with radio frequencies and so on. You can apply a magnetic field to this to tip it downwards. So if we focus just on this carbon nucleus, so what we've got is basically a spinning bar magnet, north-south, which is spinning like this. Its angular momentum is in this direction. If I wanted to take that object and force it to tilt downwards like that, tilt by 90 degrees, or in that picture, tilt by 90 degrees this way, what direction of magnetic field would I like to apply? What direction should the torque be in? First of all, what direction would we like the angular momentum to change in? What is the change in angular momentum that we would like to produce? From here to here, we want to tip it to the right. What is the change in angular momentum? It's a little vector. What direction does it point? Okay, use your hands. Everyone use your hands. What direction does it point? Right, so most of you are getting that. Some of you are going like this. Okay, so yeah, so it goes that way. We want to take this angular momentum and we want to add an angular momentum in this direction. Okay, so the new angular momentum is now in that direction, so we've partially tipped it. Okay, so we want the change in angular momentum to be in that direction. Well, that's the direction of the torque then that we need to apply. So the torque needs to be a vector in that direction, which means the corresponding twisting force is this way. I'm curling my fingers this way. So I need to apply a twisting force this way to it, and then it will tip that way. Okay, so how can I apply a twisting force this way to this magnet? What direction of magnetic field should I apply? Okay, everyone use your hands again? Okay, so most of you are getting it. Yeah, back. Okay, back towards you guys. So if we apply a magnetic field that comes out of the board, okay, then it's going to basically, you can think of it as pushing on this north pole and pulling on that south pole. So it exerts a torque, a twisting force that way. So we apply a twisting force this way, and it causes it to tilt over that way. Okay, and then we just apply that twisting force for a certain amount of time, enough time so that it tilts over sideways, 90 degrees. Okay, so that's here. So it says here, rotate carbon with a pulse. So that's basically a pulse of magnetic field. And that rotates it from this state to this sideways state, okay? And then you turn off that pulse. And now what's going to happen? Now we've got a magnet which is tipped over sideways like this. So north there, south there, and it's spinning in this direction. So its angular momentum is that way, spinning in that direction. But it's still in this big magnetic field, the big magnetic field produced by the superconducting coils. What's it going to do now? Is there a torque acting on it? The torque is this way. So we've got a big magnetic field here applied to this magnet which is sitting sideways. This magnetic field will tend to twist this thing, apply a twisting force in which direction? Okay, think of you've got a big north pole here, big south pole here producing that magnetic field. North will repel north. South here, down here, will repel that south. Okay, and so there's a twisting force like this on it. Okay, so it's tending to twist it this way. Okay, so the direction of the torque is into the board. How many of you have talked about torque in physics classes? Okay, so about half of you. Okay, so this twisting force is into the board like that. And so the angular momentum is in the change in the angular momentum is in the direction of that twisting force, which is into the board. And so it will cause the angular momentum to change to that. And so it will process around like that. Okay, so it'll go around and around and around like that. Okay, which is what they're showing here. Okay, it's like this, and it's spinning around and around and around like this. And it's spinning actually quite fast. And it's spinning quite fast. Here on this side it's fast, here on the other side it's slow. It's spinning fast because the magnetic field that this magnet is experiencing is the magnetic field due to those superconducting coils, the big one, plus the tiny little one coming from the proton next to it. Okay, so you've added them up. You have an extra strong magnetic field there, and it's rotating extra fast. Okay, and so what you do is you let it, after rotating it by 90 degrees, after applying that quick little pulse there, you tip it down like this, and then you turn on your stopwatch, and you let it go for a very short amount of time, the time it takes for it to spin around, let's see, it starts pointing, to spin around exactly 360 degrees. Okay, so that will take a certain amount of time, some certain number of nanoseconds, and that's where super accurate atomic clocks come into play. So when you look at that setup they got at the IQC, they have a super accurate atomic clock there, okay, which is able to time things out to like extreme accuracy. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but you can imagine this is a very short amount of time, and you have to time it out very, very precisely. Okay, so you turn it on and you just let it do its stuff. You let it do its precession around like this, and then once it's processed all the way around once, then you send in another pulse to rotate the thing 90 degrees up. Okay, so it says here, rotate back with a pulse, with a magnetic pulse. Okay, and so then this carbon atom, at the end of the day, after you flipped it back up again, after you flipped it clockwise up like that, then you'll notice that there's a difference between the final carbon nucleus and the original. Originally, it was pointing up, and now it's pointing down. Okay, so the carbon atom has flipped. Okay, and so when we think of this in terms of, we're going to be thinking about this in terms of quantum computing in a minute, so zeros and ones, it has changed, for example, from a zero to a one. You flip the bit from zero to one, is what's physically happened. Okay, so, okay, all that's very fine. Yep.
So, if the top is spinning this way,
yep.
The bottom is
or? Yeah, that's right. So they will be spinning in the same, So, if at the top the angular momentum is in this direction, so it's spinning like that, and then what you do is you, you tip it like this, it's still spinning like this, and then you let it process, okay, so I can't really bend that without rotating my body, so you go around like this, it's still doing this as it's processing around that way, and then at some point you catch it, and then you tip it back, you tip it back this way.
So how is that different from that? Like, why is that?
Oh, okay, so let's see. So it's like this, and then it's like this. So on the one case, if you're looking down at the top, if you're looking at top view down, we're talking counterclockwise rotation. And then if you go like this, now it's clockwise rotation. Yes, that's right. So if you look like this, then yeah, it's the same. It's the same. That's right. Okay, so that's a good question. Okay, so does everyone see that it is the same if you're looking down like this? But if you're looking from the top, okay, top down, it's going counterclockwise. If you're looking from here, top down, because the angular momentum is now down, you're going clockwise. So looking top down on it, or in the one case it's going this way, in the other case it's going this way, spinning the other way. And why it has a different energy has to do with what is the direction. Suppose I start with a magnet that's horizontal like this, north-south, put a big magnetic field like this, what is the direction this will naturally tend to go? It'll tend to go this guy down and this guy up, right? That's the north up here and that's south down here. So it'll tend to rotate like that. So it will naturally go here. Okay, so if you started it in the opposite, if you started it with north up and south down, it's in an unstable equilibrium. in that there's no torque acting on it, and it won't do anything. But if you just touch it a tiny bit, then it will start, and it'll just go whap and flip down like that, and then sit down here. So it's an unstable equilibrium, kind of like this is. If I put a ball at the very top of a hill, it's stable, it sits there. But if I give it the tiniest tap, it will roll down that hill. Okay, and so its natural state, its lowest energy state, is this. In the sense that, suppose we started out in this state, okay, and when it's down like that, anti-aligned with the field or whatever, to get it from this state to this state, I will have to exert a torque. I will have to exert a twisting force. This is its natural state. To get it to that state, I will have to physically twist it. And when I'm physically twisting something, I'm applying a force moving through a rotational angle. And so I'm doing work. I do work in getting it from here to here, so that's a higher energy state.
So you have higher magnetic field and you have in order to flip it, right? The work is done by the field.
Yeah, the work is done by the field, that's right.
Let's say you turn off the field.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay, so after you remove the field, does it still have that energy? Well, not really, because there's no, I mean, it's sort of like an energy relative to something else. If you remove the field, then you can rotate it in any direction and with zero effort. And so now it's all the same energy level.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the difference in energy only makes sense when there's a field.
That's exactly right. Difference in energy only makes sense when there's a field. And that's very important because when we're talking about atoms, sort of a sidebar here, when we have atoms, atoms have certain energy levels. So we talked about that. So we talked about the ground state, first excited state, the 1s, the 2, all these kind of orbitals, right? And then electrons, there can be 2 electrons in each orbital and all that. There are, some of these have multiple, especially up higher here, some of these have multiple quantum states that have the same energy. Okay, so there are multiple ways in which the electron can exist that have the same energy. So multiple different patterns, like orbitals. Electron orbital like with this shape, electron orbital with that shape, but they all have the same energy. Okay, but then if you apply a magnetic field to it, then that magnetic field will one orbital will have a slightly different energy than the other orbital. And so what you get happening is you get a splitting of levels. Okay, so with no magnetic field, these are your energy levels. You apply a magnetic field, and maybe there's five ways that the electron can exist that are all the same energy. Well, now they split into five different, let's say three, just for simplicity, three different levels like that. Okay, and then all of these split, and you get various, you can split it. And then these are maybe these are optical frequencies, photons of basically around visible light kind of frequencies, 1 electron volt. These are much, much smaller. These might be microwaves or radio waves or whatever, that kind of stuff.
So those correspond to like the P orbital?
These do here. These are the S, the P, the D, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Sorry, I missed the last part of that. So the basic orbitals are labeled by this integer n. So the energy is basically minus 13.6 eV. Divided by n squared. N squared, right? N squared? You guys know this, n squared. Okay, so when n is equal to 1, we're talking about this level. When n is equal to 2, we get this level 3, and so on. And up to infinity, we get 0, up to 0 energy here. Okay, and then for each value of n, if n is, say, equal to 3, then there are certain values of L. Then you remember the values of the L, the orbital. So it's 0, 1, 2, and then for each value of L, there's a value of ML, which goes from minus, say for example this guy, minus 1, 0, 1. Okay, so those are all, so all of these, all these different values of, for a given value of n, all the different values of L and ML are all degenerate states. They all have the same energy. Okay, and then when you apply magnetic field or do other things, you can split these levels and actually see that there's a difference between them, make them have a different energy level. And when you talk about SPD, all that stuff, you're talking about the n value. Okay, so that's that. So let's shift over to this picture over here and say, okay, well, this picture is exactly the same as this picture. The only difference is we have started with the hydrogen nucleus flipped around. Okay, so the proton here is flipped around. It's now going down like that, and so this magnetic field is in the opposite direction. It's now up. Okay, and so the big magnetic field from the superconducting coils is down. This is up. It reduces the magnetic field strength a little bit. So we go through the exact same process. We apply the exact same magnetic pulse to flip the carbon down. But now, when it's naturally precessing between here and here, this amount of time, the magnetic field that's precessing in is weaker, and so it precesses more slowly. Okay, so in this case, let's see, we went around one full time, 360 degrees. You'll see here, we go from here to here. We go only 180 degrees around. So it basically precesses at half the rate exactly, let's suppose, for sake of argument. Okay, and then we apply that pulse to flip it back up, and now we notice, oh, look, this is exactly the same as that. Okay, and so C is unflipped. Okay, so does everyone understand the basic physics of this? Okay. All right, super. Okay, so... So this is a physical manifestation of a quantum gate called a C-naught gate. Okay, so the C-naught gate, we could just draw a picture of it, is, you know, something like this. Okay, and so let's see, how should we represent this? So basically, this is the the inputs here to this gate are either 0 or 1. So let's call this input A, and this is input B, and this is output C. So we'll make a little table here of possible inputs versus the output. Okay, so so B here is called the control signal. Okay, so when B is 0, then A can take two possible values. It can take either the value 0 or the value 1. Okay, so when B is 0, this thing is a do-nothing thing, as I mentioned yesterday a little bit. So that means whatever A is here, if it's a 0 or a 1 here, C is the same 0 or 1. Okay, so A is just transferred over to here, 0, 1. If the control bit B is instead a 1, then what it does is it acts like an inverter. Okay, when this is a 0, that's a 1. When it's that's a 1, that's a 0. Okay, so the two possible inputs are 0 and 1, but they get flipped now to 1 and 0 as outputs. Okay, how many of you recognize this table? How many of you have studied a little bit of digital logic? What is that truth table?
XOR,
exclusive OR. Okay, exclusive OR in classical digital electronics has this gate symbol, two inputs and one output, okay, with little curvy lines here and so on. This is called XOR, exclusive OR. So it says that the output will be a 1 if either A or B is 1 but not both. Okay, so that's called exclusive OR. okay. So what's the connection between this table here and this physical picture? Well, obviously here, this control bit is the hydrogen atom, and the input here is the the output here is the carbon here. Okay, so according to this input, when the input is 0, so in other words, when the hydrogen atom is pointing down, let's say, then if we have an input here, so this is sort of both input and output. Okay, so if we have an input that's up, then the output will also be up. or if the input were down, the output would also be down. Okay, so this corresponds to the case on the right there in that picture. Have I got that wrong? Yeah.
How do you make sure that I can distort
it? So you can make sure it's pointing down just by sort of setting the initial state. So you can just, so you have your sample, and then you can, you know, blast it with a really strong magnetic field and get them to all their lowest energy levels, for example, or all their highest energy levels. Well, in the molecule, you will, so you have a given molecule, so it's got maybe a bunch of atoms or whatever, and one of them is the carbon and one of them is the hydrogen. There might be other ones, but you don't worry about those other ones. Like, supposing maybe they're far enough apart that their magnetic field doesn't have much effect. So, or if they do have some effect, then you just account for that effect.
So when carbon turns, that doesn't give a photon.
Oh, yeah, it does. So they interact mutually. So we're just sort of, we're taking the point of view that one is the control and one is sort of the input and the output. But you can, I mean, this truth table is just, whatever you call it, it doesn't matter. It just means you have two inputs and you have one output.
Yeah, so while carbon is turning, how yeah. do you make
the
hydrogen stable?
Oh, well, let's see. So the hydrogen is, so how is it that we flipped this, basically? We flipped it by applying a radio frequency pulse, which selects just the carbon. Okay, and so it just, so it will flip just this carbon, and it doesn't flip this guy. So in other words, in order to flip something, you have to do something special to it. You have to apply a radio frequency pulse to it. Otherwise, it just won't do anything. It won't flip. Yeah. Okay. So is that all clear? Okay. So the difference, so far all of what we've been saying is totally classical. There's nothing quantum about this at all. Okay, so how does quantum enter into this? Yeah, so how you read out the state, how you know the state, it's in various states. One way you can do it is just to sort of initialize the system. So hit it with a really strong, you know, magnetic field, which tends to align everything or anti-align everything, and so you sort of start with sort of a normalized state. And then from that state, you then apply radio frequency pulses, you know, assuming that's the state it's in, then you apply radio frequency pulses and do this, that, and the other thing. And then, does that help a little bit? So it's sort of like you start in a state that's known, and then you do things to it. And then so you know where it is just by knowing what you've done to it. Yeah. Okay, so how is this quantum? How can we make this quantum? Yeah. Yeah.
How can you have a truth table if the particles are in a superposition?
Okay, so this leads to the next point. So how can you have a truth table if particles can be in a superposition? Okay, so that's the question of how is it that, so far this is all just classical, how is it that we can make this whole system quantum, and what does that exactly mean? Well, it means exactly what you're getting at here. What it means is that in quantum mechanics, if we have something which can be in two possible states, say spinning up or spinning down, then what we can have is a superposition, a linear superposition. So just like the particle in the box could be moving to the right and to the left simultaneously, we can have a particle that is both spinning up and spinning down at the same time. What do you think such a particle looks like? A blur. Okay, we're actually going to talk in a fair bit more detail about that fairly shortly. Okay, so what I want to just say is just generally speaking, in sort of rough language, what we're saying is that these inputs, so this carbon atom and this hydrogen atom don't need to be either, you know, up and up, up and down. Here they're just, you know, in the beginning and end states here, we're just showing them as either, you know, pure up or pure down. But they can be in a superposition of being up and down at the same time. Okay, and so so what we get to is a kind of a quantum parallelism. Okay, so it's this is a super, super rough kind of idea of this. Suppose we have a black box like this, and we have inputs like this. And if these inputs, suppose we have two inputs, and we're talking just a classical computer here, there are four possibilities for these inputs. It's either 0, 0, or it's 0, 1, or it's 1, 0, or it's 1, 1. Those are the four possible input combinations. And corresponding to those four possible inputs, there can be four possible outputs. In the case of this truth table, those outputs are 0, 1, 1, 0, respectively. Okay. Now, with a quantum computer, what you can do, in essence, is you can take these input bits and you can put them in a linear superposition, which is both 0 and 1 simultaneously. And so the answer, like what comes out of this computation here, is also a superposition of all of these answers. Okay, so there's a certain sense in which you can do calculations on multiple different inputs at the same time. And that's what that's a very, very loose way of describing the inherent power in quantum computation, is that quantum superposition. That's really at the heart of all of this. So so let me just say just I'll give you an example in a second, but let me just say that this C naught gate here, okay, which we have realized physically in this simple system with atoms and magnetic fields and basically nuclear magnetic resonance, if you take this thing and you add to that the ability to rotate. Okay, so this is what we were told at the IQC yesterday. Add the ability to rotate spins like this. Okay, here's it's spin up now. I have this radio frequency pulse. I fly it here and I can rotate it by 90 degrees this way. I can rotate it any which way I like. Okay, if you have those two abilities, a C naught gate plus the ability to rotate, then you can realize any quantum computation. These pair of functions form a universal set of functions. From this, you can construct anything. And for some of you who may know a little bit about digital logic, it turns out that, for example, this gate is called a NAND gate. So a NAND gate is a universal gate, in that given just a NAND gate, you can construct any digital logic circuit whatsoever. Any classical computer can be constructed by having as many of these as you want and connecting them up in various ways. Okay, so it's universal. Okay, so you see how it's just physically possible to build a quantum computer. Okay, and in terms of its applications, we heard a lot about Shor's factoring algorithm, for example. And I don't want to get into details of this. All I want to just get across is just a really basic intuitive understanding of how it is that Shor's algorithm works. And that is, at the classical level, if you're given a big number, like, you know, 4726598327, you know, whatever, 200 digits long number like this or something, or 400 digits, and you're asked to find, well, you know, you're told that there are two factors in that thing. Well, you know, two numbers multiplied together, two prime numbers multiplied together give you that number. What are those two prime numbers? How would you do it?
Start dividing.
And if this thing, obviously this is going to be an odd number, okay, so it starts, so you just, you start dividing into this thing. You know, does 3 go into there? No. Does, you know, 5 go into there? No. Does 7 go into there? And you just keep on going down the line. You try one possibility at a time because there's really no other fundamentally more efficient way to do it. Okay, and so when you have a number that's that long, it would take you a very, very long time on average to find it. I mean, you might find it immediately, the first guess, right? But the chances are small, right? So you know, to find it on average might take, you know, as people have been saying, you know, like, oh, billions of years or whatever, right? With today's supercomputers. Okay, so what a quantum computer does, in essence, is instead of trying those possibilities individually, does 3 divide in, does 5 divide in, and so on and so forth, in a sense what you're doing is you're putting those possibilities in a superposition, okay, of all possibilities. And in a sense you are trying them all simultaneously. Yeah, that's a very, very loose way to describe it, but that's roughly speaking what's going on. And then the output, you know sort of you're right, it basically depends upon time. Okay, and then the probability that you have the right answer increases the longer you wait. Okay, so that's just a very rough description of quantum computation. But you can see that the principle of superposition allows you a huge increase in computing power. The ability to do sort of this quantum parallelism. Okay? So, yeah?
I don't understand. How do you think that the technology can help you?
Can help you? Oh. Okay, so, well, that's just a matter of going back to here at the classical level. How is it that a classical computer does things with zeros and ones? So, okay, so your input, so in this picture here, your input is the initial state of the carbon atom and your initial state of the hydrogen. Okay, in this case, the hydrogen on the left-hand side, the state of the hydrogen doesn't change. Okay, so it's just this guy. It's just 1. Okay, but the carbon input changes. It's either a 0 or it changes from a 0 to in this case, it's a 0. It starts as a 0, and it ends up as a 1. Okay, so it starts as a 0 here, and it ends up as a 1. It gets flipped. Okay, so in this picture, the input of the carbon is here, the input is here, and the output is here. The carbon at the initial time versus the carbon at the final time. Right. Oh, okay. So, but at the end of the day, so what you do is you have these molecules, and you start them off in some initial state, and then you do some stuff to it, and you do some computations. At the end of the day, they end up in some final state, and then the question is, how do you read that final state? Right. So that's a much more complicated problem, and how you actually read that out. And I would probably defer to a quantum computing experimentalist as to how you actually do that. But basically, what you would do is, what you could do is you could say, this is roughly speaking one way that you could approach it. So suppose that you have a two-state system like this. So we know that, say, when it's in this state down here, we know that if we fire a photon at it, whose energy is exactly this energy difference, then this system, whether it's an atom or a particle in a box or whatever, will absorb that photon. Okay, and so then what you would do is you would just take your sample and you would fire in a radio frequency pulse, photons of this wavelength, of that energy, and then you would see, well, is it absorbed or not? If it's absorbed, then it tells you after the fact that it was in that state. That's the kind of thing that it is. But it's much more complicated in practice how you would actually do it and set it up. But that's a very good question, and that's a partial answer. Yeah.
I just want to see if I understand this correctly. So, if you want to compute something, right?
Yeah.
You can, for example, in that case, you can send in a signal that the superposition of 0101 and 0011, and then what you would get out of it is in just like one instant is the superposition of 0110.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah. So basically, you put the inputs in a superposition of different possible inputs, and then the output is automatically a superposition, a quantum superposition of the possible outputs that come from that. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yep.
How do we read out the superposition? Because when it's below energy level,
yep.
We see that it's absorbed. But
yep.
When it's in a superposition, how do we search that?
Yeah, so that question, again, I think that's certainly going beyond what I know about this, what I really understand properly about this. So I don't want to like speculate. So.
Can a model of a quantum computer exist?
A model of a quantum computer.
Like without having another quantum computer to model it?
Oh, can you make a classical model of a quantum computer? So the answer to that would be no. So what's going on with this superposition? You really require like the quantum computation. The quantum computation is sort of happening in here, okay, with these how these spins are affected and so on, and the fact that these can be in this quantum superposition of states while these spins are processing and so on, and so that the property of being in this superposition of states. You can't really mimic with a classical computer. I guess you could, but it would just be really, really inefficient. Like it would take a long time. So for a classical computer, we know that we can do many operations per second. So when you look at your CPU. It's like measured in gigahertz or whatever, so that means billions of operations per second, that kind of thing. So here, the rate at which you can do operations depends very closely on the basic physics of your system. So for this particular system, how long does it take to do this operation? Well, it depends upon the strength of your magnetic field, and it depends upon the strength of this magnetic field. So it's basically the strength of, actually, that's not true. So basically, for this operation to happen, it must be so that it must be true that the magnetic field provided by your superconducting coils is basically on the order of the same magnitude as the magnetic field produced by this very close neighboring proton here. So that the difference between this situation and this situation is, in the same time, this will process around once. This will process around only half a time. Okay, so however long that takes depends on the strength of the magnetic field and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know. It depends. So in this system, you could calculate it. You could work out the precession rate and all that, and then determine how long it takes to rotate around once in this magnetic field. Is it gigahertz? Probably. I don't know. I actually don't know. And it would, as I said, depends on the system. Maybe you're doing quantum dot technology or ion trap technology, and all of these would have different times for each quantum process.
So you have a quantum computer, and you don't use the
So if we use the superposition property or don't. So in a sense, you could make a quantum computer function classically. Is that what you mean? And then how would its speed change if now you made it function quantum mechanically? What's the change in speed? Is that what you mean? Sorry, I'm not getting the question. I'm sorry. What's the question?
The answer is very, very difficult because it's the type of problem. Quantum computer will not solve the type of problem that you're thinking about. So let's take this vacuum problem. We've got this huge number of two factors. So in a classical approach, it's a brute force method. Right? How long does it going to take? Well, it depends on cycle, how big the number is. In a quantum approach, they set up the problem properly, they'll get an output of a whole bunch of probability patterns with two high peaks right away, the two high peaks of the two numbers.
That's the one. All the other ones are all good combinations, but they're not likely to work. The two type keys instantaneously use two factors. So I don't know how to do it. It almost works that, but it's the way that the problem is set up. So it's not trying every possible combination. It's trying them all simultaneously. And the probability, and that's really what you saw the math that was talked about, the probability of the peaks, these are the two dudes that are the factors of that big number that was somehow popped in. So it's not, you can't compare them linearly, it's a totally different type of setup. Then the problem that some computer is going to solve a totally different set of problem with a laptop or a regular computer. I don't know if that helps.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah.
So with this, your carbon atom, your hydrogen atom, and your magnet, would that be one qubit? Is that the definition of a qubit?
So a qubit is just, a qubit is just this guy, just the carbon atom by itself. That's a qubit, and that's another qubit.
Oh. Okay.
And so here, you know, this input can be a zero or a one. That's a qubit all by itself. So this carbon, you could start with this carbon as being up, like in this example, or you could start it as down, do the whole thing, rotate it through 90 degrees, do all this precession, and come down, and it's flipped up. So this is this in itself. Each spinning particle is a qubit, and they are interacting with each other. This interaction with physically with the magnetic field represents the quantum computation, or helps you realize certain logic functions.
So could you switch that then and have the carbon not move and the hydrogen spin the hydrogen instead?
Yep, you could. What would be the difference? So the mass, just thinking classically, this carbon is big, right? And so it has a high moment of inertia. And this is very, very small. So this is like a very tiny spinning bar magnet. That's a big lumbering bar magnet. And so the precession rate here might be much higher. And so it would change the physics of which radio frequency pulses do you apply and all that kind of stuff.
But would it matter whether you get faster or slower?
I don't know. It would depend. So let's see. It might make it faster in the sense that, supposing that this thing processes more quickly, a hydrogen processes more quickly, then yeah, you could get from that state to that state, you know, rotate around once more quickly with the same magnetic field. And then this guy here, whether you're rotating it this, whether you have it, you know, up or down, that changes the strength of the magnetic field here. And it would be a greater change in strength of the magnetic field. That sounds like a good problem to work out. Okay, so So I hope that I've given you a little bit of a flavor for at least one kind of physical manifestation of a quantum computer. But so far, the only mention of quantum aspect is this very loose kind of statement that, this nucleus here, which represents a bit, can be in a linear superposition of 0 and 1 at the same time. Okay, let's refine that a little bit and think about what that means. So now we're going to sort of enter the quantum nature of spin here. Okay, so it's how do these little spinning particles differ from a classical spinning bar magnet? Okay, and what does this superposition actually mean? Okay, so quantum spin. Okay, so basically, I should just preface this whole thing by saying that that all of the particles that make up ordinary matter, what are those?
Quarks.
Okay, at a more basic level, what's the atom made out of? Electrons, protons, and neutrons. Okay, so these particles all have spin 1/2. Okay, so that means that, what does that mean exactly? It means that the magnitude of their spin is, it's actually the square root of 3 over 2 times h bar, isn't it? Michael, do you remember the magnitude of the spin? The magnitude for a spin half particle, it's going to be s it's S times S plus 1 square root, right? Okay, so for a half, what do we have? That's 3 halves, that's 3 quarters, that's root 3 over 2. Okay, so what that means is these particles, to say that they have spin 1 half means that the magnitude of the angular momentum of these particles, so it's like a spinning top, spinning around like that. So the magnitude of the angular momentum is root 3 over 2 times h bar. H bar is h divided by 2 pi. Okay, so it turns out that Planck's constant has the dimensions of angular momentum. Okay, and so particles like electrons, protons, and neutrons, their angular momentum, the magnitude of the angular momentum, is some small multiple of h bar. Okay, and to say that they're spin a half, what that means is that it turns out that if you measure the spin, and we can talk a little later about how you would actually measure the spin, but if you try to measure this spinning particle, so here's an electron, okay? It's just been created in some, I've taken a piece of metal and I've stripped off an electron or whatever. So an electron is floating through the air like this. That electron is floating through the air. It can be spinning basically in any direction. It could be spinning like that with a magnitude of angular momentum like that, or like that, or like that, in any direction like that. To say that it has spin a half means that when you measure the spin, and you measure it by basically putting it in a magnetic field, what it turns out that the angular momentum that you find is about any axis you find, it's either a magnitude of 1/2 h bar along the axis or 1/2 h bar opposite to the axis. Okay, so you find that although the particle could in principle be spinning just sort of in any direction like this, what you find is that when you turn on your magnetic field and you measure the amount of spin that it has, you find that it's either spinning this way or it's spinning that way, and the magnitude of the spin in along the the projection on this axis is 1/2. H bar. So I'm actually getting ahead of myself here a little bit. Or minus 1/2 h bar. Okay, so all I want to say is, I don't want to actually get into all of that. All I want to say is that when you have a spin half particle and you put it in a magnetic field, then it exists in two possible states, either spinning in the direction of the magnetic field or opposite direction of the magnetic field. So it's a two-state system. Okay, and it can be either spin up or spin down. And that is actually a purely quantum mechanical property, because in reality, if you measure the spin of a classical spinning object, it could have any angular momentum. It's got the same magnitude of angular momentum, but its projection on the z-axis could be anything, depending upon the direction it's pointing in. Okay, so at the end of the day, what we have is a two-state system, either spinning up like this, and we might represent that as mathematically using the notation that Sonia introduced yesterday. We would write this mathematically as a ket. So a ket is just this. So the notation comes from this. These are brackets. Okay, and this guy here is a bra, and that's a ket. Okay, ha ha ha. And so basically. What what you do in quantum mechanics is you measure how one state is similar to another state. So if I've got one state, the electron in one state, and the electron in another state, one of the important questions is, well, how similar are those states? Okay, and the way you would do that is you would put a little line inside here, and state one is this one, and state two is this one. Okay, and this is called an overlap. But anyways, we don't need to worry about where it comes from. Anyways, so what this is it's a line like this and a little ket like that. Okay, and that whole thing is called a ket. And you can stick anything inside here. Okay, so this is something which tells you about the nature of the state. Okay, so if we're talking about a Schrodinger cat state, where the cat is, say, here's the cat is alive, and here that's a state where the cat is alive. Here's a state where the cat is dead, and whatever. Okay, so it's just a way of representing states. Okay, so in terms of this spin, we might represent spin up as a little up arrow inside the state, okay, indicating that this is a quantum state, spin up. And similarly, it could be spinning down like this. Okay, and we would represent that as a down arrow like that. Okay, so it's a two-state system like that. Okay, so whenever you measure the spin, these are the two possible states that you find it in. You never find it in any other states. Which is really, really odd, because the fact of the matter is, as I just said, the electron, when you've just created it, it could come out and it could be spinning in any direction. Not necessarily this one or this one. But whenever you actually measure it, you find there's only this or this, and never anything in between. Yeah?
Why did you only use
Keck? So the bra is used, so we could also do this. The bra is also used, and it's used, so I don't want to get into all the details of quantum, but basically kets are used to represent states, and when you want to find out how much of this state looks like that state, you take one of those states. So here I have two states. Okay, so this is maybe the electron in a particular, you know, s orbital or something like that, and then I have another state, which is the electron in, say, a p orbital or something like that. And I want to know how much does this state look like this state. What I do is I convert this ket into a bra. And then I take this thing and move it over here. This is just all notation. And so this is the notation for asking the question, how much does this thing look like that thing? So you would use the bras when you were asking questions like that. But when you're just talking about the states themselves, you can just use kets. Okay. Okay, so I don't want to get into all the formalism here. Okay, so yeah.
Does the velocity of the spin remain a constant?
Yes, that's a good question. So does the velocity of the spin remain a constant? So the answer is yes. Whatever these particles are, electrons, protons, or neutrons, unlike a classical spinning top, well, you can spin it up, right? I just have to attach that motor to that thing and spun it up. Or I can spin it down by just applying, you know, friction and all that stuff. I can add and remove angular momentum. With elementary particles like electrons, protons, and neutrons, the spin is permanent. It's like forever. The electron always has exactly the same magnitude of the spin. It can be pointing in different directions, but it has exactly the same magnitude. You can't change it. If you do change it, you destroy the electron. It's either it has that magnitude of angular momentum, or it's not there at all. I mean, that's an eternal thing. Yeah.
What is the magnitude?
So yeah, so the magnitude of the angular momentum for spin half particles is √3/2 h bar. So that's what. So that's the magnitude of the angular momentum for spin half particles is that. Yeah. Okay. So here's the question I want to ask. Okay. So the fact is that the electron can come out and it can be spinning in any direction. You know, this way, that way, the other way. But when you actually measure it using a magnetic field, you find that it's either spinning this way or spinning this way, and nothing in between. So in a certain sense, the electron is just a spin. It's just a two-state system. Okay. So if it were spinning in this direction, I would use that state to describe it. If it were spinning in that direction, I would use that state to describe it. What if it's spinning in this direction? What would I do? Superposition. So the fundamental property of quantum is that I can use superposition. So there's a certain sense in which, so let's just draw a little axis here. So that's up to the right and coming out. And so if it's spin up, I use that guy. If it's spin down, I use that guy. If it's coming out like that, say out toward you guys, so it looks like it's sort of like halfway between spin up and spin down. And so it's sort of like an equal part spin up and spin down. And so one might guess that this state here is basically this plus this. Okay, yeah.
I'm sorry, understood. Didn't you just say that when you measure it, it comes out either 1/2 inch or 1/2 inch?
Yes.
And how do you get?
How do I get something in the middle? Oh, so I'm just saying if, okay, so this the electron could in actuality be spinning sideways like this, okay? But if I were to actually measure it, I would essentially force it to choose between this or this, and after the process of measurement, it would be in this state or this state. So the act of measurement would change the state from this to either this or this. Yeah. Yes. Sorry, let me back that up. So the way you actually measure it is you have a beam of electrons, and what you do is you apply a magnetic field, and so basically it forces the electron to be, you know, either this or this, and then you put it in a it's a little more complicated. You also put it in a non-uniform magnetic field. Okay, so that the magnetic field is, say, all down, but it's stronger up here than it is down here. So the particle experiences a gradient of magnetic field. Okay, so that, so this is getting to the Stern-Gerlach apparatus. Okay, so the way it actually works is, so just for the sake of argument, let's suppose we have a particle that comes in spinning up. So back to our classical picture here, what we've got is a north-south spinning bar magnet like this, and we have this thing in a magnetic field, north-south over here. Okay, and what we do is we make that magnetic field non-uniform. Okay, so let me just back up. If it were uniform, and we threw the particle in this direction, and it were actually spinning at some odd angle like this. Okay, so it's flying through this magnetic field like this. Then before it reaches the magnetic field, it's just doing this. It's doing nothing. It hits the magnetic field, and what happens? It precesses, right? So it does this. So it goes like this. And so it precesses on this cone right here. Okay? So it just precesses on that cone. As it's flying through, it's precessing on that cone, and then when it leaves, it just stops precessing. So maybe it entered like this, and then it starts to precess as it's going through, and then however long it spends in that magnetic field as it's flying through, it might come out pointing in that direction. Okay, so that's first thing to say. The second, does that make sense to everyone? The second thing to say is that what you do in the Stern-Gerlach is you make this magnetic field. Yes, it's in this direction, and it will cause this precession. But on top of that, you make the magnetic field non-uniform. Okay, so you make the magnetic field strong here and weak here. Okay. So when you look at this, you say, okay, well, this is a strong magnetic field, north, this north is close to that north, and it's feeling a strong downward force. Okay. This guy here, this south, is repelled by that south, but the field is weaker in the lower half of this magnet. And so it feels an upward force, but it's weaker. Okay, and so the net force is a stronger downward force than the upward force, so the net force is actually down. And so if you make the field strong here and weak here, and it fires in like this, yes, there's the precession, but on top of that, there's a net force downward, and the trajectory bends down. Okay, so basically by measuring, so that's like that. If you have a magnet coming through like this, with north up, and it's spinning like that, as it flies through, it will get deflected downward by a certain amount, depending on the strength of that magnetic moment. Okay, if I now send in a particle that's in the opposite direction, so it's north down here and south up here, then you can convince yourself that the force is in the opposite direction. It's like that. OK, Okay, so you can distinguish between a particle spinning down or spinning up by putting it through a non-uniform magnetic field. The amount that is deflected will be a measure of its spin, of the amount of spin it has along that axis. And that's, in fact, how people determine that for an electron, the magnitude of the angular momentum is either plus half h bar or minus half h bar. That's the amount of angular momentum it has along the z-axis. And so you throw in an electron, which could be spinning in any direction. It just comes from, you know, a hot oven or something like that. And it's just flying through the air. It could be spinning in any direction whatsoever. And so one would expect to see particles deflected in all possible angles like that. But the surprising thing is you find there's only an up beam and a lower beam and nothing in between. Like if you take a particle, an electron, which is spinning sideways, and put it through this non-uniform field, it's not going to cause any deflection because the north and the south pole are at the same level. It's stronger here and weaker here, but if the magnet is horizontal like that, the north and the south poles are in the same strength of magnetic field, and there's no force. Okay, so sideways electrons, you would expect them to come through like this. You would expect an entire spectrum here, but you see only this and this, and that's the essence of the Stern-Gerlach experiment, and that's the weird quantum nature of spin. Okay. And that's why we say there's. I didn't want you to go through all that because we're kind of running out of time. But basically, that's why we say we have this two-state system. And then the question is, well, we know that the electron can obviously be in this state, just coming out of the board. Given those two states, how do we represent that state? Well, so our guess is that it's just a linear combination like that. Okay, and basically. There are coefficients in front here, so let me just sort of jump ahead here. In general, we can represent the state of a spinning electron as being a general linear combination of up and down, like this. Okay, and the basic fact is, what are these numbers? What are these coefficients? What do you think those coefficients are? What do you think their physical meaning is? Right, the probability of finding it in spin up or spin down. Okay, so if I take the number A and I take the magnitude and square it, that will be the probability that when I take an electron in this state, whatever that is, and fire it through this Stern-Gerlach, that'll be the probability that it will end in the upward beam, that it'll be deflected full up. So A squared is the probability it'll be deflected full up, and B squared is the probability it'll be deflected full down. So it's got to do one or the other. So what is a squared plus b squared? Equals 1. Okay, so in this case, what should these numbers be here? What would you say? Square root of 1/2. So 1 over root 2 and 1 over root 2. Okay, so this describes this particular quantum state. So if I fire this guy through the Stern-Gerlach, it's coming in horizontally like this. There's an equal probability. If it's going to flip either this way or this way, it's obviously equally probable it'll go this way or this way. And that's just pure quantum randomness that comes in, okay, this way or this way. And the probability is the square of this is 1/2 that it will flip up and 1/2 that it will flip down. Okay, so. Having said all of that, let's now try a different case. Let's suppose that we are at this angle. Okay, so instead of being straight up or horizontal, it's at an angle theta toward you, like this. How would we describe this state? It's got to be a linear combination of up and down. What are these coefficients here, do you think? How do they depend upon theta? Sine and cos. Which one? This is cosine? Excellent guess. Okay, so let's try if that works. If we put theta equal to 0, cos theta is 1, and sine theta is 0, so it's telling us that when it's up, the state is just this cat. So, yay, 1 point. Okay, what if it's at 90 degrees? Cosine of 90 degrees is what? 0, sine of 90 degrees. Okay, so when the angle is 90 degrees, then it's telling us, so it's coming out like that, then it's telling us that component is 0 and this is full on. And it's spin down. It's telling us that that's spin down. Uh-oh! That's not right, something's wrong. When we put in theta equal to 0, we get the right answer, but when we put in theta equals 90 degrees, it's telling us that it's spin down. But we know that spin down is this one. So what do we do? How do we fix it? This is close. What? This is a superposition of answers here. Complex numbers? Yeah, that's good. We will have complex numbers, but here it's just still real. Theta by 2. Okay, so theta by 2. Okay, so now let's check if this works. If we stick in 0, cosine of 0 is 1, sine of 0 is 0, so that works. When we stick in when we stick in 90 degrees, cosine of 45 is what? 1 over root 2. Sine of 45. Okay, so we get 1 over root 2 this plus 1 over root 2 that, which is this answer, which is our previous answer. When it's sitting out like this, we stick in 180 degrees. Cosine of 180 over 2 is cosine of 90 is what? Sine of 90. And it's spin down. 0 spin up, full spin down. Okay? So that's right. And then I'll throw this one out for you very quickly. So what if it's spinning in that direction? What do we do? So go back to this picture here. I mean, this picture here was based on the idea that this squared plus this squared has to equal 1, and they're equal. It's equally likely that it'll flip up as to flip down. So these numbers are equal. Well, if I have it going this way, it's equally likely to be flipped up or flipped down when I measure, right? So how could I distinguish this state from this state? So I'm saying what I'm led to is writing down the exact same thing down here. But then that won't distinguish this state from this state, and clearly they are different. How could I distinguish them? Complex numbers. So what you would do is you could do this. You could do that, put a factor of I there. Because this is the magnitude of a complex number squared. Plus the magnitude of a complex number squared. If I take the magnitude of this squared, well, I is a number whose magnitude is 1, you know, pointing in the pure imaginary direction. So this is, if I take the magnitude of this squared, I still get a half. Okay, but by having the I in there, by being allowed to have that freedom to have complex numbers, I can now rotate this thing. Okay, and so complex numbers are inherently associated with spin. Okay, and final question I want to ask, because we have to go in about 30 seconds. Final question I want to ask is, what happens if I take this state like this, and I rotate it around like this, through 90, through 180, through 270, through 360? Okay, I should get the same thing, right? I've taken an object, and I've just rotated it end over end once. I should get the same thing, right? How many say the same thing? How many are skeptical? How many sense a trap? Okay, so let's try. Let's put 360 in here. So we've gone all the way around 360. 360 over 2 is 180. What's cos of 180? What is sine of 180? So it's telling us that the state after 360 degrees of rotation is equal to negative spin up. So it's negative the state, or just negative spin up, let's just call it. Is that puzzling? Is that odd in any way? Okay. What if we rotated it around again? So we've gone already around once, 360. Now we go around once more to 720. Now what do I get? Cos of 720 over 2 is cos of 360 is plus 1. Sine of 360 is 0, I get this. So psi of 720 degrees, the state of the electron having rotated it around twice end over end is now positive this. It's the original state. So the point is that quantum mechanics is telling us, or just simple basic reasoning. We say, experimentally, we observe two possible states, up and down. Simple common sense tells us that for sideways, we do this, and then we get a little bit tricky. For an angle, we do this. And then for, on this axis, well, we introduce I and all that other stuff. But at the end of the day, it's telling us that if I rotate an electron through 360, I don't get the same thing back. There's some way to distinguish, like if I take any object like this, okay, I take it, I put it behind my back, okay, and I bring it out, okay. So you can't tell whether I've rotated it 360 or 720 or whatever, right? Right. There's no way. There's no way you could tell, right? Well, if you can't see it, okay. But what this is saying is, if I take an electron and put it behind my back like this and turn it around, and bring it back out again, you guys should be able to tell whether it has been turned around an even or an odd number of times. There's something different about it. What exactly is different about it? That's like really freaky. And you can actually observe this, but I do believe that we have to go. So you can observe this using, it was observed in the 1970s, a very simple experiment with neutrons. Should I show you one last demo that will take like 30 seconds? Okay. So this idea of rotating twice around to make it the same, I have an ultra high tech demo here. Super high tech here. It's made out of tape and string and old film containers and all that. And let's hope that I can do this. Let me pull this off. So I'm going to require the assistance of two volunteers. Yep. We're going what? I'm not sure. What does the schedule say? I think we're the bistro. Aren't you going shopping now and then going to the bistro after? Okay, I'm going to have to look at the schedule, but I need a volunteer, two volunteers, quickly. Up, up, up. Come on to the front. Okay, so I need someone on top of the table.
Standing?
Yep. Super. Okay, so hold that guy up there like that, and I need someone down here. Holding this guy like this. Let me untangle this. Okay, holding that guy like that. Okay. So the plan here is this. What I'm going to show you is that if we rotate this around once, then the strings are going to get tangled up, and we won't be able to untangle them. But if we rotate it around twice, we will be able to untangle the strings. Okay. So here's what we're going to do. So I'll rotate it around once. Okay. So that's half. That's one. Okay, so now I could demonstrate, but we actually can't. It's hard to demonstrate something you can't do. So you actually can't untangle the strings now. Okay, so now we're going to rotate it around twice, a second time. So that's half, and then once again. Okay, so now it's rotated around twice, and now I claim that we can untangle this. So the idea is, if we could bring this guy up a little bit, just to give us a little bit of slack here. Okay, so without rotating these guys, or rotating this guy, or rotating this ball, I'm going to take this and this. Okay. And I did it the wrong way. Okay, I did it the wrong way. Okay. Okay, I'm gonna do it this way now. Okay. I always do it the wrong way. I did try this beforehand. Okay. So this is back to the original state. Okay. So now I'm going to do it the right way. Okay. Which is around here, like that, and then this guy around here, like that. Okay. So I haven't rotated the ball in any way, and voila. Hey! Thank you. So, the purpose of this is just to demonstrate, like, what does that mean that you have to rotate it twice to make it the same? Is it in some way, is the electron in some way connected to the environment in some way so that you have to rotate it twice, like with weird kind of strings like this? You know, it's just, anyways, the whole thing is quite weird. All right, so, time to get on the bus. Yes, Krajov.